Good afternoon. Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, director of Friends of the Eel River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center. Today's show is the second half of an interview we recorded with Eric Loomis, a labor and environmental historian at the University of Rhode Island, who writes about the history of labor unions in Pacific Northwest forests and the intersection of that history, the history of the environmental movement in this region. Eric, do you have even a rough framework in mind for sort of the key periods in the evolution of forest labor across the Northwest?
Yeah, for sure. In the mid to late 19th century, when people are moving into the Northwest, where logging exists, but it's not a huge industry. So it's dangerous work, but it's mostly people working fairly near their homes, dropping big old growth logs into rivers, pulling them out by animal labor,
right.
Difficult, hard work. But it's relatively localized and not that central to the larger industrial processes of the United States until about 1890. And by 1890, the U.S. had basically deforested itself. At the end of the Civil War in 1865, you do have a good bit of deforestation in New England, but you have these huge untapped forests in the Great Lakes as well as in the American South. By 1885, they're all gone.
Right.
They're all being used to basically fuel the American Industrial Revolution that begins before the Civil War, but just explodes in the years after. So in the 1880s and 1890s, you have people like Frederick Weyerhaeuser, who move his operations from Minnesota to Washington, where he acquires 900,000 acres of land in southwestern Washington in 1890. And that really brings us to a modern industrial kind of forestry. But what happens is that, you know, you have these very rapid operations. There's no reforestation going on through these forests, and they push the forests farther and farther back. And what that means is that workers in the forest are people who are basically these itinerant laborers who are going from camp to camp without permanent homes. It's brutal work. They're dying from accidents. They're also getting sick. You have horrible unfinished housing, fleas, rats, other kinds of vermin. Disease is a huge problem. Sanitation is a huge problem. And in 1916, there was a doctor, Red Cross doctor, because by the 1910s, this is becoming an issue. People are taking notice of these terrible conditions. So there's this Red Cross doctor named Dr. W.H. Lipscomb. And Lipscomb, he's kind of an industrial hygienist. And so he's going around the Northwest looking at logging camps. Right? These are the kinds of brutal conditions that lead loggers in the 1910s to join the industrial workers of the world. And we talk about the industrial workers of the world and we think about it as a revolutionary, you know, one big union, all of that. But the reason these guys are joining them is because they're sick and they're dying. And the IWW knows that. And so the IWW basically says, we'll organize around these issues and we will hope to convince you of revolution. Okay. And there's a lot of success in doing this, so much so that by 1917, there's a huge strike and the country can't get wood for World War I. And so the government steps in. It fixes all of these sanitation problems, and they force the companies to do this by saying you won't get government contracts if you don't. In return, though, they crush the IWW.
Right.
But the IWW wins in some way, or the loggers win anyway.
But the loggers who got killed in the infamous Everett Massacre weren't there fundamentally for revolution.
Yeah, you certainly had some who were revolutionaries. There's no question about that. And in Washington State, especially, is a hotbed of radicalism in the 1910s. You have the Everett Massacre of 1916, the Seattle General Strike of 1919, the Centralia Massacre of 1919.
Right.
So Washington has a lot of this, but most of those people who are dying in 1916, dying in 1919, are just dying every day in the mills and in the forests. I mean, they're really fighting for a better life. I mean, they're fighting for just the most basic kind of life that we would want, an actual permanent home. They're fighting for an 8-hour day to have decent food on the table. They're fighting to not have the toilet, just been an outhouse, right next to the cookhouse.
Right.
These are the things that they're fighting for.
Really elemental conditions. So
absolutely.
One of the things you raise in that introduction to the rise of timber labor is the importance of the rise of the railroads, and then the changes in technology seems to be a huge part of this.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see the actual introduction of the chainsaw until World War II, but there are enormous changes that really alter the structure of the industry with the introduction of what we now know as the steam donkey.
Right.
Yeah. So how do those play into
it? Well, yeah, it's the arrival of the railroad in the 1880s that allows Northwest timber to become part of the nation's industrial might. Sure, they were logging beforehand in small amounts. They were sending it to San Francisco by ship or sending it to Asia. And so they were part of a world economy, but a small part. But what is this wood really needed for in the 1880s and 1890s? To prop up coal mines, to serve as fuel for factories, for the railroads themselves, for housing. But, you know, as part of this industrial revolution, of course, you have massive and very rapid technological innovation. So the steam donkey, as you mentioned, and other technologies that basically allow companies to effectively just tear timber out of the ground and move it to market with great speed and in huge quantities allow for the Northwest to become part of a global economy. But at the same time, given that we're talking about the 1890s here, there's no protection for workers at all. It's very much, you know, buyer beware. If you don't want to take this risk, don't work here. But then, of course, there's no other jobs.
Right.
So what else are you going to do? So the relationship between technological innovation, the growth of global capitalism and working conditions and environmental change is all very closely connected, because even by the 1910s, you have real deforestation problems. And there's a huge debate. What are we going to do with this land? Because despite this talk in the 1880s, 1890s, that, hey, this timber can last forever, it can't last forever, as we all know. And so you really begin to see the first discussions of this in the 1910s. And some people are saying, particularly the companies who don't want to reforest, are saying, you know what we should do is we should sell it for cheap to small farmers.
Right.
And they'll turn it into a small farm. Well, that's a terrible idea, because most of it was poor land. It was also strewn with these, you know, stumps from 200-foot Douglas fir trees in southwestern Washington. How are you going to get out that fir, that stump? Like, you're not going to. And so they have these diagrams and these magazines to teach people how to do this. Hey, here's how you set the dynamite.
Right.
It's completely ridiculous. But you begin to see more of a push for reforestation. And this goes back to the original conservation movement in the 1910s, because America's like, if we're going to remain a world power, now that we finally have reached world power status, we need to have consistent resources. And so that's when you see the development of the U.S. Forest Service in 1905, for instance, which was intended to produce a permanent supply of timber.
But was also aimed to protect the watersheds that, that the timber...
Absolutely.
That's such a key part of.
Absolutely. Water and water pollution is a major issue at that time. And that's really when you begin to see emphasis on protecting watersheds really around the country. The book that I'm writing looks at logging unions and how they serve as agents of environmental change and how they provide a kind of collective organization for workers to express their environmental desires and as well as try to shape that environmental agenda. And in the 1930s, you have, with the rise of the New Deal and the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, the ability for workers to unionize in large scale in this country for the first time through the passage of the National Labor Relations Act that forces companies to sit down and bargain in good faith with their employees. And in the Northwest, two unions develop. You have a conservative union led by the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, which are by far the most powerful group in the North Coast of California.
Mm-hmm.
And the Carpenters only got involved mostly because the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, which had opposed the organization of workers based upon industry-wide status. The AFL had refused basically to organize the big new industries. They refused to organize women. They refused to organize minorities. They refused to organize children, all of which were big parts of the labor force because they were trying to protect an older style of labor of a skilled white male who made enough of a salary that his family wouldn't have to work. But when it looks like in the 1930s that, hey, you know, Franklin Roosevelt has created the conditions where you're going to see this mass unionization, they get involved and they create a subunion called the Lumber and Sawmill Workers Union that begins to organize some of these timber workers. And they're going to, throughout their history, have a very conservative view when it comes to many things of union-based, but especially forestry policy.
Mm-hmm.
Really, from the 1930s on, where they will fight any kind of conservation efforts. In a vague sense, they'll support it, but basically they're going to follow the timber industry edicts on this. On the other hand, you have the development of the International Woodworkers of America. This is a true industrial union, comes out of the carpenters, affiliated with the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the more radical industrial-based unions that begin in the mid-1930s. And this is a communist-led union in its early years. It has members in both the United States and Canada. The Canadians especially were particularly radical. And one of the things that they're going to push for very strongly, especially in their first 10 years or 15 years of existence, is a quite radical and surprising environmental program. It'd be them and the carpenters hate each other, and so they're battling, attacking each other all the time, and the carpenters are red baiting the IWA, and the IWA are calling the carpenters industry hacks and these sorts of things. But the first real policy battle they get involved with is in 1938 over the creation of Olympic National Park. And the IWA is one of the biggest supporters for the creation of Olympic National Park, saying that this is beautiful land that should not be cut, and that the people of the Olympic Peninsula can create a more permanent, sustainable tourist economy than just cutting this amazing area once and letting it go. And that was incredibly controversial, and they're supported in this by many of the New Deal leaders, people like Henry Wallace, who was Secretary of Agriculture and later Vice President. So they are tapping into a kind of a network of people who are really pushing for a more intense conservation, but you would not expect that from a labor union whose job it was to provide work for loggers. But they have a much more complex view, whereas the carpenters are absolutely outraged by this. They want it all cut, just like the timber industry does. In fact, they use the IWA conservation program against them. One of my favorite quotes is in 1939, where right after the beginning of World War II, when the Germans and Soviets invade Poland, the carpenters in their newspaper, the Union Register, run a story about how the IWA is talking so much about conservation so that everybody will forget that Comrade Stalin just made a deal with Adolf Hitler, basically saying that conservation is just a big red bait, is a part of this communist plan.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson, director of Friends of the Eel River, and I'm talking with Eric Loomis, who's a labor and environmental historian now at the University of Rhode Island, who writes about the history of work in the Pacific Northwest forests. And we're talking particularly about the forgotten history of labor unions in Northwest forests. So, Eric, you were talking about this history that seems like has almost been lost of the conservation advocacy of some of the more radical unions like the International Woodworkers of America. Lay this out. I mean, this is a fascinating story for me because you're basically making the case that the union activists were bringing to the fore arguments that the environmental movement would later use decades later.
Yeah, and really beginning in 1945, the IWA takes a very aggressive stance toward the timber industry. They hire a professional forester, a man named Ellery Foster.
Really?
Yes, and he comes out of a kind of left New Deal background, and his basic premise, and this will be the IWA forestry program for really the rest of the 1940s, is that the timber industry is destroying the forest, and that this needs to stop. And the first thing that needs to stop is clear cutting. That clear cutting is unsustainable, it is destroying the resource, that 50 years down the road there will be no jobs, that it's creating all kinds of problems with erosion. I mean, they point out in their paper once that, hey, workers on the Puget Sound, look how muddy the Puget Sound is after all this rain. Who's to blame for this? It's your employer. And so they make these incredibly powerful arguments, and the timber industry hates this man, Ellery Foster.
I can only imagine. Yeah.
They hate the IWA because he goes to their conferences, American Forestry Association stuff, and basically says everything you're doing is really wrong. And, you know, if you really want to save your private enterprise that you talk about so much, you'll want to be in business 50 years down the road.
Right.
That doesn't last forever. Foster eventually leaves and actually becomes a pioneer of organic farming and back to land movements in Minnesota in the 1960s and 70s. He's a very old man. He's kind of a mentor to these hippies. So he has a whole fascinating career of his own. And in the 1950s and 60s, after the communists are kicked out of the IWA in 1948, that program takes a back seat. But it's still always kind of around. And in the 70s, under the leadership in 1976, a man named Keith Johnson takes over as the president of the IWA, and they really rejuvenate much of this program, making alliances with environmental organizations, supporting wilderness, sitting on the boards for the creation of Three Sisters Wilderness, even in the 1950s.
That's in the Oregon Cascades.
They're members of the groups that are doing this, that are pushing for this. And even in the 1970s and 1980s, in a few of my conversations with IWA members, their jobs are at risk, but they also see environmentalists have a point. And so what my work is going to show is that the history of work and working class people in the Pacific Northwest forests is a lot more complicated than we think it is. That working class people did have complex relationships with the forest, and in many cases, particularly within the leadership, but also the members of the International Woodworkers of America, a real willingness to criticize the timber industry on forest policy itself. However, the carpenters never did that.
Right.
All the way until the 1980s and later, the carpenters took that conservative line. And so that's one of the main differences between these two timber unions.
And I came out of college in the very late 80s and went to work for an organization called the Oregon Natural Resources Council. And my first week getting paid was the week that the spotted owl appeared on the cover of the Time magazine. And we were at the epicenter at ONRC of those owl lawsuits. We had 13 different lawsuits running. I was assistant to the conservation director, Andy Kerr, and in that time, we had holy hell from especially the Carpenters Union and a constant barrage of questions about why we didn't care about workers. And one incident that really has always stuck with me is the time when Jesse Jackson came out to Oregon and we took him on a little tour of Oregon old growth, the little piece of old growth that was close to a road because Jesse didn't get out of his suit. It was real clear that the forest was completely beside the point to the Reverend Jackson. What he was there for was to deliver a message, which was that the unions were making life really difficult for the Democratic Party establishment, especially in Congress, and couldn't we just give them something? Couldn't we compromise on this stuff? And it's always seemed to me that the industry has this sort of asymmetric power through unions like the Carpenters Union. Not only are they joining these crazy lawsuits challenging listing the spotted owl or protecting fish or habitat, but they're also maintaining these ties to the Democratic Party establishment, and where the environmental movement increasingly can only reach Democrats. We can't even talk to Republicans. This gives the industry the ability to work directly through both parties at once.
One of the things that's frustrating, because the IWA as union itself is an exception on a lot of these issues. There are a couple other, really. The Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union was a real leader on these kind of issues as well. So there are some examples, but most of your unions working on natural resource issues tended to, on a leadership level, follow a company line on resource. And the problem with that was that they don't trust the company on anything else.
Right.
So why would they think the company would have it in mind? I mean, you look at the North Coast, right? 1978, you have these huge protests led mostly by the Carpenters Union in conjunction with industry over the expansion of Redwood National Park. Loggers go to Washington. They drive log trucks through Sacramento. All kinds of issues around here. How are they repaid for that? Well, Louisiana Pacific busts the union in 1983. That's how they're repaid for it. And so it's almost, if your employer believes that something is good for you, you should probably disagree on principle because you're probably right, even if you don't know it, you know, because the union got nothing for this. They got nothing from these companies to help. Even as this stuff is going on in 78, Louisiana Pacific is building a mill in Mexico.
Right.
So that they don't have to, theoretically, they claim, oh, the wood will dry faster in Mexico, but that's not the real reason. It's that it's cheaper. They're basically cutting their workforce here. And I think that one of the problems that environmentalists face in dealing with these issues, and this affects both within the Democratic Party and public relations and all these other things, is that a lot of times what's happening is that the jobs are going away anyway.
Right.
They're going away because of mechanization, because they've overcut the resource. In that case, because they were exporting raw logs to Japan. But it's hard for workers to point the finger at any of those things. You could point a finger at Washington, but that's so general. And you can point a finger at Japanese stealing our logs or whatever, but everybody knows that the Japanese aren't stealing them, the companies are selling them. And you could point the finger at technology, but that's not going to get you very far, probably. But who can you point a finger at? It's environmentalists. It's the people there with their long hair, those hippies, you know, and that's something that you really see happen. And of course, the companies stir this up because they want to make cover for themselves for their own actions by saying, oh, no, it's those people who are costing you your jobs, right? It's not me building a mill in Mexico, laying off all these people. It's not us busting your union. It's these environmentalists. And so that's something that is a constant issue that the environmentalists have to face. And in a party structure, it's absolutely right that it helps allow an organization like the timber industry or the coal industry or whatever influence the Democratic Party because they know that environmentalists can't have conversations with Republicans anymore for various unfortunate reasons, but that they can get their foot in the door. And of course, the need for campaign donations also helps the companies be able to influence Democrats as well. But they do, the unions too often provide cover. And that's what's happening in West Virginia today with United Mine Workers.
Sure.
And that situation that's going on there right now.
I'm Scott Greeson, director of Friends of the Eel River, and I'm talking today with Eric Loomis, a labor and environmental historian, about some of the lost history of labor and of the environmental movement in the Pacific Northwest. Eric, it seems to me that another piece of the story that I think is in danger of being lost is some of the efforts that did happen to try to build solidarity and sort of cross-cultural connections between the environmental movement and workers on the North Coast. Two of the really obvious pieces of that story are work that focused around Judy Berry trying to organize under the Earth First banner with workers, especially around the Georgia Pacific Mill and Fort Bragg, and then the efforts to work in solidarity over the crisis that Maxim Corporation created when they staged a hostile takeover of Pacific Lumber and liquidated the company and its old-growth redwood inventory. I know a friend of mine went to work at the behest of union activists in a Kaiser aluminum plant to help deal with a strike-breaking effort there. You know, there was some real innovative work there, and yet it feels like that's largely been lost, and now we're back at a place where, to the extent we actually have a functional labor movement in the North Coast, it's really at odds with environmental interests. And how do we get beyond that?
It's interesting to me as I read documents produced minutes from Wilderness Society meetings, let's say, in 1987, 1988. They're wondering, where's union? Where's the IWA? Where's labor here? Because we've had these alliances before and we can talk through some of these things. But what's happening is that there's no jobs anymore. The IWA is getting decimated.
Right.
You know, their numbers are in complete decline. In fact, they so much so that in 1994, they're absorbed by the International Association of Machinists. They don't have enough people to have their own union anymore. There were these alliances that had existed. And one of the things that I talk about is you know, you have in some cases environmentalists and unions working together on issues like pollution,
right?
Like pesticides. Not only are these pesticides being dropped on the forests, affecting trees negatively in the wildlife and the water, but they're also affecting workers' health. And so you did have this. And just the other day, I was reading old issues of a newspaper that was produced around here called Country Activist. And Country Activist was a paper that seems to be Earth First in orientation, if not really a direct Earth First paper. And they talk about a number of different kinds of left activists, things going on the North Coast and around between 1984 and I believe 1990. And what's really interesting about that is that you have a lot of conversations happening in the pages of that paper between the local IWA here, that's Local 398, and these radical environmentalists, where you have the IWA people and sometimes independent loggers as well, just regular workers sometimes, but sometimes the official spokesperson for the local union writing in and basically saying, you know, these companies are doing these terrible things. You know, we can kind of work together on this, some of this stuff. And some of these Earth Firsters saying, you know, the IWA is a good union.
Right.
And we really support what you guys are about. Now, there's a lot of tensions there, too. And sometimes those tensions come out. But there was dialogue happening. And that dialogue, the fact that that was happening is important because there was some ground for compromise. Now, what that compromise could have looked like, if you're talking about the complete ending of old growth logging on redwood forest, that's a tough thing for loggers to necessarily swallow.
Right.
And that's something that the IWA expresses is that, hey, you know, our job is really, in the end, our job is to provide employment for our members. Like, that's something that we have to do. So there's no easy answer. And today, I mean, it's a situation that belief that environmentalists are opposed to working people not only is sort of the ways that scholars sometimes too often think about this, but it also is just in the general ether. And so just regular everyday folk will buy into this too. Well, those environmentalists, they don't care about jobs. Well, I mean, the reality is that you have groups like Wilderness Society who are coming up with some fairly sophisticated economic plans. And basically, they're pointing out all the real reasons that the jobs are going away.
Right.
Here's ways that we can build an alternative economy here around tourism, around small logging operations, all kinds of different things. And Earth First does less of that kind of articulation of alternative economies, but they did some of it too.
Mm-hmm.
I do have some documents where they are thinking about, okay, what is this going to look like?
Well, the part of that history that I lived through, what I saw was certainly groups like the Wilderness Society doing what they do very well, which is producing the white papers and the sort of sophisticated analyses. But it was the Earth Firsters who were actually marching on the picket lines with striking workers at the plywood mills in Southern Oregon. It was Earth Firsters who were doing solidarity actions with the workers on the Mendocino Coast.
Yeah.
You know, it was very much a sort of radical to radical connection that didn't happen as easily between the more mainstream elements of the environmental movement.
Yeah, some of that is class-based.
Right.
That you had your Sierra Club, Wilderness Society member is more likely to be somebody who identifies as a comfortably middle-class individual.
Mm-hmm.
Earth Firsters, of course, come from a wide variety of backgrounds, some of which are fairly wealthy, but there is a kind of conscious rejection of that,
mm-hmm.
oftentimes in favor of more radical critique of society. And of course, the somewhat anarchic nature of Earth First makes it very difficult to generalize and characterize, but it's certainly these kinds of examples of Earth Firsters coming in and saying, you know, the company's really treating you terribly, again, suggests that there is hope there. But there's no easy answer. And I think that's ultimately what I have to say is that people are still figuring out what is the answer here? And I think that the environmental movement learned a lot from Spotted Owl and sometimes alienating working class people through rhetoric and other things that's unnecessary. I feel like environmentalists have a much more sophisticated take on these things than maybe they did 25 years ago. But has that really led to any real progress in creating permanent alliances with working class people? Well, you know, I mean, obviously the biggest issue on the ground around that right now is West Virginia with the decline of the coal industry. But part of it has to do with what West Virginia is about, the history of that place. But there's a tremendous amount of hostility in West Virginia toward environmentalists by these coal miners, even though just like in the Northwest, the real reasons that the coal mining jobs are declining is mechanization. It's that they've overused the resource and a lot of the easy to get coal is gone. It's also the move of the coal industry to Wyoming in the Wind River Basin, where you have just incredibly huge coal mines that nobody really knows about, because that's a pretty isolated area too. And it's because consumers have moved in recent years to cheaper fuels,
which also have less carbon impact. Yeah.
Right, which have less carbon impacts. So there's all kinds of reasons for the decline of jobs in coal in West Virginia. And today, I mean, it's just a small fraction of the employment of 50 years ago. Yet you have this just incredible hostility among West Virginia, the West Virginia working class. You know, West Virginia in many ways is the last old conservative state to go Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And so that process that we were seeing in the 70s and 80s and 90s and throughout the South was just took place later in West Virginia. And I think that the levels of racism in West Virginia and the fact that we have a black president is part of it. So there's a number of things going on there.
But fundamentally, it seems like one of the dynamics is that when you have a movement of an active, in-your-face attempt by environmental movement to make change. It's in the streets, it's on the roads, it's in people's faces. In my life, it was activists chaining themselves to bulldozers and being physically on the logging show and having to have very tense conversations sometimes with timber workers about these issues. There are confrontations there. That itself is just inherently really unpleasant for a lot of people. That's where I saw in my life expressions of real contempt and resentment.
There's a few things going on there. I mean, some of it's cultural. And this was, I think, especially true in the 80s and in the early 90s and a kind of in a society, in a period where the kind of hippie is, so it kind of tapped into this earlier sense of that, hey, these just like these draft dodgers, these hippies and their love-ins, that these environmentalists need to go get a job. And so there's that kind of a generational thing is part of what's going on there, particularly in the kind of circumstances you're talking about, as well as some of the fashions, the look, those kinds of things.
Right.
There are these cultural issues. And one of the things that unions have the potential to do, and one of the things that an organization like the IWA tried to do, is educate members about these broader issues, because your average guy or woman who is working 10 hours a day, maybe only has a high school education, when they go home, they're going to watch TV. And that's fine. I mean, that's part of what unions are about, is allowing you to do what you want to do. So people might not have, though, the
8 hours for what we will.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, but 8 hours for what we will might be educating yourself about the issues around you, or it might be, you know, watching television. And that's fine. But that is what the union can do. That's what the IWA try to do, is say, hey, here's these issues that affect your job. And here is what we is put all this money, we collectively use your dues money to create policies that are going to affect you in a positive way and to fight bad things. And here's what we think about these issues, especially down here where the carpenters were always more powerful. The education effort put out by the Carpenters Union over the decades was minimal, whereas the IWA tried much harder to educate workers on that. And the issue of worker education with unions is always very, very difficult. I mean, maybe the most famous example is the United Auto Workers trying to convince their white employees to accept, to allow black people to be on the floor. Mm-hmm. And these huge fights between workers and the union leaders over this issue of race. And so these questions are always very difficult, particularly here on the North Coast, but especially as union jobs were going away throughout the Northwest, you just had less education efforts taking place. And so it's easier for companies to exploit people who feel threatened.
I want to say just how much I appreciate your willingness to take the time to explore these issues and to document and keep alive these stories. I hope that your book comes out soon. We'll get you back on to talk about it.
Absolutely. I'd love to be back on, and I really appreciate you having me.
So this has been the Eco-News Report. My name's Scott Greeson, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest has been Eric Loomis, professor of environmental and labor history at the University of Rhode Island. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Thereafter, you can find the files from recent shows posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. You can find Friends of the Eel River, the organization I work for, at eelriver.org. If you have questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco-News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. None of this could happen without Fred McLaughlin, who makes it happen every week. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco-News Report.